Coming up on the FSR Sarkfighter podcast, Laura Runge Gordon has had a tough go of it.
And for me, it was the start of what became a full-on sarcoidosis, neurosarcoidosis diagnosis.
And then she suffered the bone-thinning effects of prednisone.
Just going to the bathroom. I sat down and I heard it snap. I heard the bone just break.
Meanwhile, our friend Royce Robertson is getting back on his bike and raising money to fight sarcoidosis.
The ride from Syracuse to Albany is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 160 miles. And then Albany to, we want to get right down to the tip of Manhattan, down to the Battery. And that's about 180, 181 miles.
This is the Sarcfighter Podcast, living with sarcoidosis and other rare diseases. Here's your host, John Carlin.
Hello, this is episode 109 of the FSR Sarcfighter Podcast. I'm your host, John Carlin. This episode is brought to you by Atire Pharmaceuticals. To learn more about their new pulmonary sarcoidosis trial called EFSOFIT, visit stopsarcoidosis.org/atire-trial. That's ATYR-TRIAL. And there is a link in the show notes, and there's also more information on the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research's website. Of course, I do this podcast. I want to help you understand what's going on with you and to help give you a sense of hope as you deal with this unpredictable disease. And I do hear from a lot of people. I get emails all the time at carlinagency@gmail.com. Get a lot of emails from people saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. I don't know anybody else who has sarcoidosis. I don't really understand what I'm up against, or I understand it and I don't like it. And I'm trying to get maybe a sense of perspective. But it just helps to hear what other people are dealing with, or John, what you're dealing with. I get that sometimes. So anyway, that's why the Sarcfighter podcast is here. And today we'll be hearing from fellow Sarcfighter Laura Runge Gordon. She'll be sharing her story with us. Laura's an English professor, a full professor of English, and was also the department chair for her university, and she'll talk more about that. But she was responsible for 170 employees, which is a lot. That's a lot. And I've worked in higher education. And 170 people answering to you at a university is, that's a lot of different opinions. That's a lot of different smart people who you have to kind of help and or manage. And you're the go-between between the administration and the employees, and you're a professor yourself. And she was dealing with all of that when sarcoidosis decided to come knocking on her door and the pandemic struck. And she was dealing with it all at the same time. You talk about stress. Oh, I can't even imagine. And so she is going to tell us about her path to diagnosis and then all the complications from the side effects of the medicines. And when you hear how she broke her leg, you're going to be kind of amazed, because it wasn't like she was parachuting or something like that. And I'm just going to leave it at that, okay? Meanwhile, Royce Robertson, another fellow Sark fighter who is no stranger to regular listeners of the podcast, will join me. We'll have a brief interview with Royce this time around, but he's planning another round of what he calls Cycle for Sark. That's a fundraiser where he's riding his bike across New York State from west to east. And I don't know. Depending upon where you live, I lived in New York State for the better part of, a good part of my life. I can't say a better part anymore, but I grew up in New York State. And if you haven't looked at New York on a map, you will see that it is a long way to get from Buffalo on the west to Albany in the east. That is no easy task, all right? It's not something that you just do in a day, all right? Royce will be sharing the dates. He'll be talking a little bit more about the background for his fundraiser. And I got to tell you, he's also pimped out his bike a little bit, which of course, I think is pretty interesting because I'm a bike geek. So I just asked him a couple of questions about how he's made his bike a little bit more rider friendly than it was when he bought it, because he did use that bike for his fundraising event last year on Cycle for Sark, and he's going to pick up where he left off on the trail, and I'm just going to let him tell you all about it, give you the dates, tell you how you can contribute, and I hope you will. I will for sure, and let's raise some money for sarcoidosis and help make Royce's effort worth it. Okay. Now, on the just quickly on the personal side, if you've listened to the podcast, you know, anyone who knows me knows that I've kind of always had an adventurous spirit. I'm not like a, you know, Red Bull video adventurous. I'm not going to jump my bicycle off a cliff, but I am going to ride my bicycle. I like cycling, as you know, and I was a marathon runner, fly fishing. I've had some pretty exciting assignments as a reporter. I don't even know if I've ever talked about it on the podcast, but a few years ago, I was invited to go land on an aircraft carrier. And do that. And that was really something. Spent several days on the USS Abraham Lincoln. We went in and we caught the wire and did all that. But before that, I had to go through a day of survival training in the pool where they dumped us upside down underwater and we had to swim out and get to the surface. And, you know, I mean, okay, that's not the most adventurous thing in the history of the world, but it was for me, you know, but I really look forward to that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I've done some kind of fun things as a reporter, television reporter as well. So the thought of slowing down is kind of new to me, but right now, and this is, I'm talking about it because this is what's been going on with my wife and me for the past couple of weeks. I'm starting to look at slowing down on purpose because, believe it or not, I know I look so young, but believe it or not, I'm nearing retirement age, and I'm close enough that if I signed another contract at work, it would take me past your typical retirement age, and my contract is coming due, right? I mean, by the middle of this year, I'll either have to sign another contract to stay on at the television station or not, you know. And, you know, and I'm thinking that I will, but I, you know, I feel great. I have lots of energy. I'm working out. You know, I'm riding my bike. I'm out doing yard work. I'm looking at building a stone wall, maybe something, you know, kind of a little bit strenuous in the backyard, some landscaping projects. So I feel okay, but sarcoidosis is not that far from the front of my mind. I don't want to say it's in the back of my mind because that would be putting it too far back, but it does change your perspective. So, you know, you work and you do work that you enjoy if you're me. But the question is now, you know, do I want to work until I'm 70, 75? Or I think, man, and I've talked about this a little bit and we've heard other people on the podcast share this sentiment. Do I rush to retirement just in case Sark comes back? I mean, there's a lot of things that I want to do in this world that are not work-related. I have told you in the past that when I really got hit with Sark, I looked up and said, I've never seen the Grand Canyon. And damn it, I don't know if I'm going to get better. And so I made plans and I went to the Grand Canyon and really enjoyed it. And so that, you know, but there's other things out there that I'd like to do. I don't know if I'll ever get the chance, but I'd like to go see the Tour de France or the Tour de France. There are some things that I would like to see around the world. For whatever reason, I want to go to Iceland. And I don't know, I just kind of have a thing in the back of my mind that I think that would be cool. And a lot of places that are in the United States that I haven't seen that I want to do or that I want to see. So now I'm looking around because with this contract coming up, I've kind of got away. What do I want to do? And you know, not the least of which is, do I have enough money saved to even do those things if I retire? Will the cost of medication become prohibitive? because I have sarcoidosis. You know, if I take Humira, is Medicare going to cover Humira? I don't know. I mean, I hadn't had to think about it, but now I do. And then, you know, I've got seven grandkids now, and I have to look around and say, well, you know, they're getting older. I mean, you know, the oldest is six, but when you start thinking in terms of 3-year contracts, you know, that is going to advance them well into the middle of elementary school. And I don't do great with very small children who are non-communicative or, you know, I'm going to be the papa that likes to take the kids fishing. And, you know, they're not quite old enough to do that other than, you know, if we're on vacation and we're all on the dock, I can bait a hook and they can reel in a fish. But I want to take them out in a canoe. And do that, because so they're kind of getting into that sweet spot for me before they become teenagers and they don't want to spend any time with their parents or the grandparents or, you know, the whatever it is that the teenagers do anymore, play with their phones. So, you know, do I want to be working when they're all arriving at that sweet spot? Right? Those are the types of things that I'm thinking of. I don't have those answers, but now all of a sudden I only have a few months to decide. And so Mary and I are beginning to dig into our financial picture, at least get some answers there. And because I've worked at several different places throughout my career, which started back around 1980, so a long time. So I've got a small pension here from this business and multiple 401k accounts. And, you know, all of a sudden I'll be looking at Social Security. And, you know, so there's a whole question do I have enough money? And then, you know, do I really want to keep up with the daily grind of TV news? I mean, you know, every day, I've always threatened to do it and I never have, but, you know, just the daily death toll that we report on. And I'm not talking about people who, you know, a jetliner crashing in another country. I'm talking about the number of people who die from unnatural causes that make it to the first block of our newscast. People who are murdered, died in a fire, a traffic accident, maybe, you know, the rare disease or cancer or something like that. You know, the death toll, I mean, it does take a toll on those of us in TV news because we just talk about it all the time. If you could sit in an afternoon editorial meeting and we're tossing around, you know, what's going to be the lead story, you know, which often translates into what is the most tragic thing that rises to the top among all these tragic things that are on the table in front of us on any given day. And, you know, and we're just so cavalier about it because you have to process that information. It's just what you do. But I can't say that I love it because I don't. Even though I like the assignments that I've had, you know, landing on that aircraft carrier, I mean, that was one of the coolest things in the history of the world for me. But day in, day out, that's not what it is. You know, those are the sort of the special things. So, you know, do I want to keep doing that? So grandkids, sarcoidosis, money, all those things. And, you know, and is there, maybe I keep working, but I don't work in TV news. Is there something else out there that I could do that I would enjoy before I'm essentially all done with my working life? And how does sarcoidosis and the way you just feel like sarcoidosis closes your window a lot. I mean, that's the way to put it, right? I thought I was going to be fit forever. And I was always that active person. You've heard me talk about that. And now that window is closed just a little bit more than it would have been, maybe a lot more. Or there's the perception that it's closed more, and you better jump through it before it closes all the way. So that's what I'm thinking about this week. I don't know if you have sarcoidosis, if you have changed the way you look at the world, the way you think about the world, but just some random thoughts about things that are going on with me right now. All right, I want to pivot quickly to Royce because I am so happy to have connected with him. He's raised a bunch of money last year. He's back at it again this year. It's Cycle for Sark. That's the word cycle and then the number 4 and then Sark, and you squeeze it all together and it comes out Cycle for Sark. And I talked to him about it last week, and here's where Royce is right now. Joining me now is Royce Robertson, a fellow Sark fighter and a fellow cyclist who also is a fundraiser for FSR, and he's got another fundraiser planned for this year. Royce, welcome.
Hey, John, it's great to be back. Hope that your 2024 is starting out wonderful and you've got dreams of rides in the sun coming up.
Same to you. And I know that you do because you've got kind of big plans to pick up where you left off last year, literally and figuratively, I guess, with your ride across New York State.
Yeah, absolutely. Last year we did, my buddy Jerry and I, we rode from Buffalo, New York to Syracuse on the Erie Canal Trail. It was about 186 miles total. We ended in downtown Syracuse at the Dinosaur Barbecue and had some ribs and slaw and enjoyed ourselves, celebrated. And absolutely, this year we're going to try to pick up and start from the exact same place and go from Syracuse to Albany. And then later in the summer, go from Albany down into Manhattan.
Yeah,
so two rides.
Two rides. And for people who don't have New York's geography ingrained in their head, basically, you're going to go from east or from west to east, almost straight across New York. Yep. And then when you get to Albany, you turn south, and that's how you go to New York City. And that's a pretty good haul right there, too.
It is. The ride from Syracuse to Albany is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 160 miles. And then Albany to, we want to get right down to the tip of Manhattan, down to the Battery. And that's about 180, 181 miles. So we're still aiming for about 60 miles a day and hoping that it's a little drier than it was last year. We fought a lot of rain and you know, we've got a couple of little side trips here and there. Hopefully we're going to squeeze in, you know, visit some nostalgic towns in the Hudson River Valley, like Rhinebeck and Ossining and places like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds amazing. And that, so the second leg of your summer, 2024 is in August, right?
Yes. Yeah. The first ride is going to be May the 28th to the 30th. So starting the Tuesday after Memorial Day. So May the 28th to the 30th, we'll go from Syracuse to Albany. We'll actually, you know, we'll ride through Little Falls. And so we'll give a wave and then we'll head south, Syracuse to Albany, May the 28th to the 30th, and then Albany to Manhattan, August the 6th to the 8th.
Wow. So total mileage, that's 300 plus for sure. 400?
Yeah. Not all the way to 400. I think it's, geez, do the math. 340, 350.
Okay.
And then on top of last year, that'll get us about three quarters of the way through it. Summer of 2025, we're planning on doing the New York Canadian border, or what's called Rouse's Point, all the way down to Albany. And that's probably the toughest segment. It's got the most elevation change. It's the most mileage on roads. But that'll allow us to, Jerry and I, to complete the entire 750 miles of the Empire Trail.
Well, this is all near and dear to my heart. And you mentioned Little Falls, and everybody is probably thinking, why would he say Little Falls and wave? Because that's actually, that's not exactly where I'm from. My parents live about 9 miles north of Little Falls in the country. And if you think of a town as small as Little Falls, and then you say out in the country relative to Little Falls, then you're really talking out in the country.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Little Falls, if you go along the Erie Canal, is the home of the world's, it used to be the largest lift lock in the world in terms of raising a canal boat up or an ocean going vessel up to raise it up high enough and get it around the rapids and then get it back into the canal. And I now believe there are a couple around the world that are higher, but that was Little Falls' claim to fame for years and years and years. And as a kid, we'd go down and picnic and watch the boats go through. And that was, you know, that was a big time when you're 10, 11, 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, Yeah. But I don't want to get too far aside from your trip. So last year you raised quite a lot of money with your Cycle for Sark program. Let's back into that a little bit, and then we'll look forward to what you're doing this year and how people can help.
Sure. Last summer, we had a grassroots family and friends approach and managed to raise $7,500, roughly $7,500 for that 180 mile ride from Buffalo to Syracuse, and did it all through the FSR rally bound page and took the donations and started to, I think our first phase here is build capacity. We want to make sure that we have enough available to start saying to patients, those that are fighting sarcoidosis, to say, I know that someone's got my back when it comes to travel for treatment. And that's really what our mission is. Our mission is to raise money so that individuals who have to travel for high quality treatment for sarcoidosis don't have to feel as great of a burden. So we're looking to cover miles, hotels, food, all the things that go into travel for treatment. That is our mission. That is the mission that I've lived for the last 7 years, because I drive from Syracuse, New York to Buffalo to Baltimore to get treated at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I estimate that we've spent somewhere between $30,000 and $35,000. Because there were times where I was going down there 4, 5, 6 times a year. And, yes. I'm lucky. I have a decent paying job, and we have good insurance. And even then it was a financial burden to us. And I can only imagine what people who don't have those same resources available to them are feeling. They're probably thinking to themselves, I know I've heard these conversations in the halls at Johns Hopkins, where families are talking about whether or not they need to sell their second car, or, in order to get cash to pay for bringing their child or their husband or wife down to Hopkins in order to get treated. And I just don't want that to happen anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is, that's certainly a very worthwhile aspect of all the different things that are needed in the sarcoidosis space. That's for sure. And when you think about how few of us there are in the United States with sarcoidosis, and how few realistically outstanding sarcoidosis clinics there are, it's just important that people be able to get to the place they need to go to get the proper treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of imagine maybe, there's someone in, Western Pennsylvania who has to go to the Cleveland Clinic, or there's someone in rural North Dakota who needs to get to Mayo, whatever it may be. Those are the people that, that I look at and say, how can I help them?
Yeah. So what are you going to do then this year in terms of your fundraising and so forth?
Yeah, so we're going to try to broaden things out a little bit more, looking for some partnerships, looking for possibly even some other foundations and corporate gifts or groups of people at different employers or different organizations that are looking to support the cause, try to find other people that, sometimes you don't... I think about the communities that I have the potential to impact, mm-hmm. The sarcoidosis community, the cycling community, and I want to be able to find people in those communities who want to be champions and say, hey, I'm willing to put together a virtual ride on the same times that you're going, and whatever we raise, we'll donate it through Rallybound, or looking for other groups that know that they're making an investment in patients, trying to find people who care about supporting closing the gap in terms of healthcare or addressing people who are on the margins in terms of their ability to to do this for themselves.
Yeah. So you talk about other groups like doing virtual rides. So somebody listening in California might go out and ride whatever distance they find challenging in California and fundraise, and then funnel the money back through this organization or through, you know, through your efforts in honor of or in partnership with your efforts. So it all winds up in this kitty at FSR for people to have travel money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the folks at FSR have been great about helping to build that infrastructure to say, you know, how can we use this the most appropriately? And what kind of criteria can we create in order to ensure that the people who need the most help are getting it?
Outstanding. So what are, when can people start helping you? When are you going to launch? What are you looking at in terms of the actual fundraising effort surrounding the ride and so forth?
Sure. The Rallybound site is always open. So there's, you know, there's not necessarily a campaign that we're doing differently than last year. It's there, and you can find it through the Team KISS website at the FSR webpage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking to do a couple of, let's say, pre-type rides, you know, just to get the legs warmed up and start to just work through some of the logistics of riding 60 to 80 miles a day for 3 days. And
That's a lot of training. You know, I mean, that's I've done a fair amount of fundraising. Specifically, used to be running marathons, and you know, when I was fundraising then for the Leukemia Society. Now it's the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, but I would say, look, I'm doing all the work. I would just like for you to reward my work with a contribution to a cause that's near and dear to my heart.
Yep.
And, you know, because I'm getting up on Saturday morning and running 20 miles in preparation for the actual event. Yep. So it takes over your life for a long time, and it's a commitment that you make. And in the end, you've got an adventure, but it's not like it, you just get off the couch and go do this.
No, absolutely not. And so I think that's the same approach for me, is to say, I'm going to start training at this amount over these weeks and really build up to it, you know. And, you know, and I'll be frank with you, you know, even though I'm doing well in terms of my recovery and my treatment, it still took a toll on my body. And I'm going to be 51 in a little over a month, and that doesn't make anything any easier. And so it's, you know, I want to be able to say to people, hey, listen, exactly like you said, is that I'm putting in the effort to get ready to do this. And if you like what I'm doing, if you believe in what I'm doing, then here's the way that you can support it.
Awesome. So you'll have a link where people can click and pledge, basically.
Yep.
Is it the same link as last year?
Same link as last year. Yep.
Okay. All right. So I'll put that in the show notes.
A little bit of the content, but I'd like to keep that. I'd like to basically say, we know that $7,500 was there already, and let's just keep adding to it and not treat it as a separate page or a separate count or anything like that. I just want to keep building on what's there. Just like the ride. We're building what we did last year, you know?
Right. I'm going to geek out on the bicycle side just a little bit, because during the long winter months there in Syracuse, New York, you've been upgrading your bicycle in anticipation of this, which is, you know, that's a fun part of the whole process too. You ride your bike when the weather's good, and you think about cycling when the weather's bad, like in the winter. And so, but when you're thinking about cycling, you're like, you know, I've always wanted this doodad for my bike, and you added a bunch of doodads to yours. So tell everybody what you got going.
Yes, I have a, you know, my doctors basically said, it would be good if you had a little bit of insurance, reassurance, you know, a little bit of kick in the tank if you need it, so that you're not straining your heart too much, especially on hills. And so I bought an e-bike. I bought a Cannondale And it's it, but it's more of a commuter bike. So it, you know, it had it, it had vertical bars, you know, normal bars. It didn't have drop bars like a regular road bike. And it had, you know, it had a super comfy seat and, you know, a lot of the kind of, let's say, cruiser type, amenities on mm-hmm. it. And last year there were times where I really like tri bars because if I'm at 15, 20, 25 miles, I like to lean forward a little bit. I like to stretch out. And I found that last year, you know, after my hands and my wrists took a lot of beating last year, mm-hmm. In that ride. And so I picked up some drop bars. I got a tri bar. I've replaced the seat with something a little bit sportier. And last year I did just the regular flat pedals. And so, replaced them again with some normal clip in pedals. And so I'll go back to wearing my cycling cleats and I just feel like it's more like my bike now, not just a bike.
Right. And, you know, for people who are listening, who are not cyclists and I apologize because, you know, I could talk about bicycles all day long. So, but you're just going to have to forgive Royce and I for a minute. But so you look at these big wide seats and everybody says, well, that's what got to be way more comfortable than that little narrow seat that you sit on. I don't know why cyclists have those narrow seats. What is that all about? But over the long haul, it's just a lot more comfortable to be on that narrow seat. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it has to do with circulation or the lack of chafing, if yeah. you will, or, you know, but sitting in that upright position is not the best way to configure your body to get maximum output from your legs and your muscles. You want to be leaning forward a little bit. And for most people, I would say that that's, you know, if you're a cyclist, your back has to learn to bend like that. But once you get your back comfortable with that forward leaning position, that's when you can really start to do some damage on a bicycle. So if you watch the Tour de France, you know, those guys are in that position for hundreds of miles every day going at top speed up and down the Alps. But yep. that's how to ride a bicycle efficiently.
Yeah. And last year that seat did take a toll. I'll tell a quick story here. You know, Jerry and I, we probably passed, I would guess we passed at least two, you know, dollar stores, Dollar General, Family Dollar, whatever, you know, whatever brand, probably two or three a day. And when we got done with the first day and we were both like, you know, like there's a lot of pain down there. Uh-huh. What we ended up doing was stopping at those dollar stores and just buying some, you know, the cheapest rag or cloth hand towel or cloth that they had and putting it down on our shorts just to have a little extra padding because, uh-huh. you know, it was like there was already pain there and we were just trying to work around the pain. Right. And I want that normal cycling seat because it has the divot in the middle. Yes. And that's where it allows your tailbone to get down into. And when you have just the big poofy padded seat, it provides direct input and contact on your tailbone. And that's what bothers me the most. Mm-hmm. I want to have somewhere where my tailbone can go that is a little more comfy.
Yeah. Those seats are good for going from one picnic shelter to the next on the Greenway, you know, go out and ride a couple of miles or whatever. But if you're going to ride across New York State, you know, I wouldn't want to do it. I hope people understand what we're talking about, but Royce, this is great. We're getting ahead of it this year. So I'm going to put the word out. Of course, I'll be making a donation as I did last year. And we want to have you come on at least once more before you go. And then after or in between your trips this summer. And I wish you all the best. And on behalf of the sarcoidosis community, I want to thank you for raising this money and taking on this big project.
Thanks, John. I appreciate that coming from you. That means a lot. You know, you are the voice of the sarcoidosis community to me. And this podcast is a great resource and an opportunity for folks like us, the small community that we are, to hear the stories of others and to get the word out. And getting the word out about what I'm trying to accomplish is important to me. And I hope that that importance translates into support and a sense of caring for those that have such great needs, like those that need to travel for treatment. And I just want to do right by them. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish. I am an open and willing recipient of any help and support that others can provide. You can, if you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Instagram at Cycle4Sarc, CYCLE, number 4, SARC. Or you can get contact information for me through John or through wherever.
Great. Well, folks, let's dig deep and help Royce out, and let's leverage this. Let's find some people, you know, like a sorority, a fraternity, a fraternal organization, somebody, you know, some way that you can get a lot of people to raise money and then channel it over through this project, because that's what you do. You know, Royce is one guy, and he's raising money, but if people hear this, and there we can find some corporate benefactors or some, you know, some other form of sponsorship that will really allow this effort to grow exponentially, that would be amazing.
Yeah, absolutely, John. All ideas are welcome. All support is appreciated. And we'll check back in later when I'm sore and have put on another 300 and something miles.
There you go. Thank you, Royce.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast. Thank you so much to Royce and for all he does. And folks, you know, Royce arrived on the scene via this podcast, and he is doing great things. And the podcast is just kind of a vehicle to help him and to help others do what they do, help FSR. And I just want to ask you to help me reach more people so that FSR and people like Royce can be as effective as possible. And it does help reach more people and grow the show if you share it on your social media, if you tell somebody else in the sarcoidosis space, hey, have you listened to the FSR Sarc Fighter podcast? Just put the word out there, because person-to-person promotion is really the best, most effective way for someone to really trust that something is worth their time. You know, you see things come up on your feed anymore and you're like, okay, well, there's a zillion things. But if somebody you know and trust says, hey, this is a really good product, it's a really good way to spend your time. I think that is a great recommendation, and it really works and it really helps. So I'd appreciate it if you would do what you can to help me spread the word of the Sarc Fighter podcast. All right, coming up next, speaking of that, Laura Runge Gordon on everything from neurosarcoidosis to a broken leg that she got just from sitting down.
Feel like a zombie, just feeding at stumbling.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the Sarc Fighter podcast. You may be wondering, what can I do to help? How can I be a part of the sarcoidosis solution? It's simple. Make a donation to KISS, Kick In to Stop Sarcoidosis. 100% of the money goes to the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research. Look for a link in the show notes of the Sarc Fighter podcast. Welcome back to the FSR Sarc Fighter podcast. Joining me now is Laura Runge Gordon, who is a fellow Sarc Fighter. Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So you have been through a lot. I mean, a lot with sarcoidosis. And
people tell me that all the time.
I mean, it, you know, and it even ends with a broken leg, which, you know, you don't normally associate with sarcoidosis, but I think that we can make a very honest connection between the two. So why don't you tell us a little bit about when you first started feeling bad? And just for reference sake, in case people are listening in the future, we're recording this on March 5th of 2024. So when did something start feeling amiss for you?
I think I would trace it all the way back to a surgery I had in, I think it was 2013. I keep my records, by the way. I actually had to go digging in the archive of Laura Runge recently to try to prepare myself for this because I couldn't remember them all. But back in 2012.
Okay.
I had a bone spur on my right hip removed, and that was extremely painful. So for that time, I've been a runner, and I was, you know, not able to run or walk very much with the bone spur. I had the surgery, the bone spur got better, and I tried to start running again. I worked with a trainer. I tried to get back to my former level of fitness. And I think I managed to do that pretty well. But then all of a sudden, my bones started hurting. My dad had rheumatoid arthritis, really, really bad. And it led to all sorts of other complications, which eventually led to his death in 2008. My first thought was that it was rheumatoid arthritis. So I went to the rheumatologist, and, you know, after a year of tests and serum negative stuff, she eventually put me on medicine for RA. And I started with like methotrexate and another type. It didn't get any better. She put me on Humira about 2 years into it. Maybe by this time, it's about 2018. Okay. And man, that made me feel better. Okay. Oh my God, I felt like I could do cartwheels. And it had been a long time since I felt that good. So I was doing well on that. Everything was under control in my bones until 2020. Now 2020 is a year of remarkable tragedies and remarkable stressors. And for me, it was the start of what became a full-on neurosarcoidosis. Diagnosis.
It started nothing like a pandemic and neurosarcoidosis to boot.
And I was chairing my department at that time, which had about 170 employees. It was a huge department in a public university, and it was really, really stressful. before sarcoidosis started, and then sarcoidosis happened, and the university shut down, and everything was put online, and it was probably the most stressful situation I've ever been in my life. And then all of a sudden, this ring finger on my left hand started doing like tricks, would just start wiggling. And then they stopped performing. You know, I was constantly at the keyboard. I'm doing this underneath.
Sure.
That worried me. And I went to my rheumatologist and I said, I think I'm having a flare. And she did more x-rays of the hand. She said, there's no inflammation there. You know, anyway, this led to...
That was a flare that you thought you were having when you thought you had rheumatoid arthritis.
Correct.
Because flare is a word that we use, but you haven't heard the word sarcoidosis yet at this point, right?
No, I never. Right. No, nope. Didn't enter my vocabulary.
And I just want to point out, you just mentioned the university, but you're a full English professor, and you were the chair of the department.
I was.
Wow.
I was for 4 years, leading up to 2020, and. My career was stressful. And since that point, I stepped down from administration, which was itself its own sort of loss for me. And I moved back into my research persona, which was great. Uh-huh. Fabulous. And I actually wrote a book during this pandemic sarcoidosis stuff, because writing for me was this real researching and writing was this really great escape.
It's like cathartic, right? Is that the word?
Yeah, cathartic and fulfilling, productive. I felt alive when I was writing. So, yeah.
So 2020, so, and you think you're having a flare.
Yeah. And so my rheumatologist did all these, you know, radiographic tests on the hands and nothing. So she suggested I go to a neurologist. And I thought, okay, that's weird, but let's do it. First MRI, oh, sorry, first the testing of the peripheral nervous system, nothing. Like, wait a minute, this is real. I wanted to tell him, you know, this is real. He said, don't worry. We have more tests to do. Because then they did the MRI of the spine and it came back with a lesion, inflammation in the C4, C5, C6 area, cervical 5, 6. And they got alarmed. And then they said, okay, let's do more MRIs. At first they were like, we need you to come in and do more MRIs. I'm like, what, why? I mean, what's going on? And they said, we think you might have MS. I'm like, wow, just floored. I mean, I can't believe it. And then, so I had the neck and the spine MRIs. And I actually asked to see the reports because I, from the very beginning, I don't trust what doctors tell me. I mean, I trust them. I really do.
Sure.
But I want to have the data myself. I want to have that information.
Okay.
So I looked at it and the differential had a bunch of things in it, including this word sarcoidosis. There were a lot of scary things in there. And one of them was sarcoidosis, and I'd never heard of this before. And so they wanted to go with MS. They wanted to do a lumbar puncture in order to test the cerebral spinal fluid. So
okay.
Find that out.
They did that to me too, just so you know. Yeah.
I know.
I know this path. Okay, go ahead. Yep.
Not fun. But this is during, it was September of 2020. So it's like the height of the pandemic.
Yes.
So I'm going to the hospital try to get this spine or the spinal fluid done. It comes back with the oligo clonal bands, which leads my neurologist to say I have MS. And so she starts treating me for MS on Ocrevus, which is a once every 6 months infusion, but it's got the loading doses.
Okay.
So I did those and I wasn't feeling any better. I was actually feeling worse and worse. And then I had this spell of what we think was pericarditis. And I had to go to the hospital because they said, anytime there's chest pain, we need to check this out. Again, I just want to say, going to the emergency room at the height of the pandemic, when you know you're immune compromised,
it was a nightmare.
So they keep me overnight. They do these tests, including CT of the lungs. And eventually they let me out. The heart didn't seem to have any effusion left or anything left that worried them. So I went home. I still had the pain in my chest, they gave me ibuprofen for it. And when I got back, I got this phone call saying, we got your records from the hospital from my neurologist. And she said, you need to go see a pulmonologist because I forget what the name was, but eventually I got the sense that it was something that worried them about lumps or something in the hilar glands, whatever. I can't remember the words now. So I went to a pulmonologist, and this is before Christmas because all this stuff is transpiring around the holidays during the pandemic. I get in to see a pulmonologist, which I don't know if you ever tried to get in to see a pulmonologist during the pandemic, but it was extremely hard.
I don't know if I know it was difficult. I mean, it's always difficult. It's you call and they say, we can see you in 6 months. So during the pandemic, everything was compounded.
Yeah. So they were thinking on their minds that it might be cancer, but nobody ever said the C word, me. I went in and the pulmonologist took a look at the, I forget what, CT scan. And he said, that is sarcoidosis. Just out of the blue. He said, he was a pretty experienced doctor. He said, I have seen sarcoidosis. That's a classic case of sarcoidosis. I have no doubt that's sarcoidosis. Really? Merry Christmas. We'll do more tests when we come back in the new year.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah,
that's it.
It was like,
okay.
It was like right. 2 days before. But he said, the good news is it's not cancer. I'm like, wait a minute. I didn't even know cancer was on the table.
Right.
This is so confusing. Head spinning.
So now you've got something in your lungs and your spine, C6.
So we still think I have MS, by the way. So I have MS. Okay. And now he's thinking sarcoidosis. My friends were getting so confused. Like, what do you have, Laura? I'm like, I don't know.
Right. Right.
So then in the new year, we wanted to have a bronchoscopy to verify the diagnosis. And that got messed up for human reasons, which I won't get into. It led to me being extremely confused, extremely frustrated, the doctors not speaking to each other or planning their treatment so that we had the best results or with any understanding of what the other doctors were doing. So I moved to the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Now, looking back on it, I have no idea how I got in so quickly to see a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic, but I did. And a rheumatology took a little longer. By April that year, I was seeing Dr. Marion Colazzo at the Jacksonville Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and she wanted to confirm whether I had MS. And I was like, wait a minute, I didn't know that was an issue. But she's like, yeah, we're going to redo the MRIs because they weren't done with contrast the first time. And
okay.
So
She
did them and meticulously explained the comparison of different imaging to show what was going on in my head and my brain. So it was in both places. And it was worrying, as my neurologist said, the Tampa neurologist said, because it's in the brainstem, essentially. So it's in the brainstem, it's around the cranial nerves, it's in the C-spine. C-spine spot was getting worse. And Colazzo told me something that I didn't know about sarcoid, and she said, or MS rather. She said MS lesions wouldn't stay there for 12 months. And that's how long you've had these symptoms. So it cannot be MS. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. Sarcoid, on the other hand, those lesions can stay a while. They can stay forever. I've had it now since 2020. It's still inflamed. But I don't know. Since that point, and I started doing all the research I could on all these things, you can imagine my research brain is just going nuts with, you know, just trying to figure out things, trying to understand. And so that's when it all started. There are lots of other interesting little stories along the way. March 2022, the treatments, the different treatments I've been on. Well, I tried to count them. I didn't actually.
So the treatments, are we talking about treatments after you were diagnosed with sarcoidosis or all the treatments you had when they thought it was a various multiple sclerosis and other things?
Well, you can see them in a sort of continuum because okay. some of the RA drugs I was on are also used for.
They are, yeah.
Sarcoid.
Sarcoidosis,
and
yeah.
When I first got diagnosed with MS, you know, diagnosed as such as it is, they took me off the Humira right away. And I was like, I was so sad to see it go because it made me feel better. But then again, it wasn't working anymore, right?
Right. Well, I mean, you were getting flares and who knows at this point, we don't know where it started in your body. Did it start in your spine and then went to your lungs or was it because that first place they found it was on your spine, right? The lesion. But we don't know where it started. It could have been in your lungs the whole time. You weren't having any trouble breathing though, that you know of.
No,
right?
No symptoms with the lungs. And it could have been in my joints and muscles. That's what my rheumatologist thinks. He
okay.
thinks going back that I've had sarcoid.
Sarcoid
in the bones and joints too.
Let me ask you before we move on. I want to ask you about your running because I have an amazing number of people who appear on the podcast, and as we're talking, it evolves that they were some sort of runner, cyclist, hiker, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Myself included. So what kind of runner were you?
Well, I ran off and on for most of my adult life, up until the age of what, 50, I guess, something like that. At some points I got more serious. I had a friend who was a more serious runner than I. Two friends actually, one local, one long distance. But it was encouraging to be with her, and I would do. She encouraged me to do the races, which I'd never done. And so I did 5Ks on occasion. And I tried to get myself up to 10 miles and longer for some runs when I was really into it. And God, I look back on this, I just loved it. Oh, that feeling of just being in the groove and running and feeling your body like a smooth engine machine going and just flying across the pavement or the grass or whatever you're running on. Anyway, I miss it. I miss it so much. But that sort of went away, as I said, right around 2013 with the hip and then the RA and everything.
All right. Well, I there's so many people who come on and they're lamenting their inability to do what they used to do.
I
And what
understand.
they used to do is often something, pretty significant in the fitness space. So, okay. So now you're diagnosed with sarcoidosis. They've done a biopsy on your lungs and they've confirmed it. And you've got a lesion on your spine, which I assume that they put two and two together and figured out that's also Sark. And so that was that, where are we in 2021 yet? Or are we still in 20?
We're in the May of or spring of 2021, and then they first put me on Remicade, and then so I started having Remicade infusions, and then they weren't working. I was trying to put this all these pieces back together because, frankly, it's a blur. Because then they wanted to more MRIs were done. They weren't happy with those. The brain was getting more involved. They put me on a higher dose and more on a greater frequency of Remicade to see if that helped. And then they were talking about putting them back on methotrexate, which they did eventually. And none of that seemed to contain it. And then in March of 22, I had another set of MRIs because I really wasn't feeling good. And I sort of pushed it up from what they were saying, every 6 months, that's not going to happen with this case, my friend. The MRI was with my neurologist was out of town on her honeymoon and very happy for her. But the guy on call read the report, saw the MRIs and panicked. I mean, he panicked. I mean, it wasn't like he had panic in his voice, but I sensed it in the urgency, his calling me directly, his wanting me to go on IV steroids immediately. He was going to set it up at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Mind you, I'd already traveled back to Tampa, which is about a 4 or 4.5 hour drive, which my husband does for me, and involves him leaving work, which I always have to consider when I make the call to go to an appointment in Jacksonville. So anyway, he called and he's like, "We really need to get you on steroids."
IV
So
steroids.
yeah. So long story to figure out how I got those IV steroids locally, because I wasn't traveling back, and then started the 60 milligrams a day, and I was on that for months,
On
and
the
then
prednisone, on
yeah, oh sorry, yeah.
or oral prednisone, 60 milligrams a day. So what they try to do is they try to shock your system into compliance with the IV, and they hit you hard with that for maybe 3 days,
Five.
5 days. Okay, for me it was three. So that's where I pulled that number. So 5 days, and then they start giving you 60 milligrams a day with the pills, and that probably got you under control, even though it made you feel miserable from the side effects of the prednisone.
Well, the And I think I was on methotrexate at that point too, which also made it just feel
great.
So sick. Yeah. So they were throwing it at me, you know, at this point. And and in August of 22, apparently, according to my neurologist, I had the best radiographic reports, but I was not feeling good. I was feeling terrible. And I didn't think my symptoms were getting any better. But they wanted to stay the course as much as possible. Eventually, they switched out the methotrexate to leflunomide because I just couldn't take it. I mean, I switched from the pills to the self-injections. So I was ready to go off of methotrexate. It just didn't help. And leflunomide, I was on for like a year.
What's the second drug you're saying? Say it again.
Leflunomide. I thought you've had this on your podcast before. Okay. Leflunomide, I think.
Okay. Okay.
It didn't do anything for me, but that's another point.
All right.
The MRIs they took in December or January of 23 did not show. I still had inflammation, Don. I still had active inflammation. The reason for the panic in March of 22 was that the C spine had moved the lesion, despite all the treatment, had moved from C5, C6 to C4, C7. So it had really expanded. And back in 2022, it had reduced back to the C4, C5 or C5,
right.
C6.
Right.
So it had worked to a certain extent, right? But the inflammation did not go away. And honestly, in January of 23, those MRIs now are sort of the baseline of what I have. They haven't changed since then, despite a bunch of changes in medication. I even did a course of cyclophosphamide, 6
right.
months. Of
Cytoxin.
Yeah. And that was miserable.
Awful.
It didn't have no change. No change. So my neurologist believes this is a rare case of very resistant neurosarcoidosis.
Mm-hmm.
But we switched to Rinvoq in September. And I started to wean off successfully of the prednisone, which that alone is making me feel so much better. And the last MRIs I had were the same as January of 23. So the Rinvoq is helping, we think, at least wean off of the prednisone. There's been no change in the inflammation. There's still active inflammation in the brain. There's still active inflammation on the spine. My neurologist, I have a local and a Mayo Clinic neurologist. Both of them are anxious for me to get that quenched because it's leading to permanent disability.
Right.
And, you know, it's a weird place to be psychologically, which I can go on about if it's of interest.
Have you seen a therapist through all of this?
Oh, I've started to recently after the bone break, which was actually very traumatic.
Right. Well, I want to hear the story of the bone break. So let's, but first about the therapist, you've just started seeing a therapist, and has that helped?
I had a therapist during the initial phase in 2022, and we worked with the therapy style that I've had before. Now I'm forgetting the name of it. Anyway, it's very rational, and I liked it, and it was helpful. But at a certain point, I knew how to take care of my problems. So.
Right.
We ended that. And then after the bone break, I decided I needed to deal with trauma now. Even though in doing it, I realized the trauma goes back further than just the bone break.
Sure. Oh, it must have. I mean, all the stress, even your work stress, if without a pandemic and managing 170 people in higher education, and I've worked in higher education, that's just got to be, it's like herding cats. I'm sorry.
All right. So imagine this.
And you've done it at a much higher level than me, but trying to tell other professors what to do is really difficult.
It is. And there's so many repercussions. And this was during a time when, besides the pandemic, the Florida State Legislature decided that the university had to combine all its campuses into one. Uh-huh. And that meant departments that had other departments on those three other two campuses had to become one department. And of course, each of the campuses had English departments. So I had to lead I forget the word we used, the bringing together of those three departments into one with all logistics that involves communication, documentation, bylaws, not to mention tenure and promotion. And yeah, it was, and budget.
that sounds like way more than one person or a committed small committee could ever accomplish.
No, I mean, I had a lot of people helping me, obviously, yeah, okay. And there's a lot of delegation involved, but still. Ultimately, what got to me was the decision making, and the way that making even small decisions about what to say in an email affected the lives of so many people.
Right,
and it was too much after a certain amount of time.
Wow, I can't even imagine. All right, so how did you break your leg? What happened?
Well, in some ways it is an interesting story, but in other ways it's just weird. I was just doing the regular things. In fact, I had been in physical therapy and doing really well that week and feeling like, wow, I might be able to walk again. This is good. And so my husband had gone away on a business trip, which he does frequently. And so I was alone in the house. My boys are grown. And I just going to the bathroom. I sat down and I heard it snap. I heard the bone just break.
Femur, right?
Yeah,
that's the femur. The big bone.
Yeah, and it was up high on it too. So it wasn't like mid femur, up high on it. Because I thought it was my hip. I thought all this problem that I was having was my hip. So I've been having pain. And I've been working on it. And I even went to a freaking orthopedic doctor to have it looked at. But because I said it was my hip, he just looked at the hip and said, the hip is fine.
And of course, we should point out that one of the things that happens with long-term prednisone use at high doses, and you were taking 60 milligrams.
I've been down to 40 for some time, but still 40.
But still. Yeah, no, I know. It's because I did it too, and it's just awful. But it thins your bones is what happens. And then you are a woman, and women tend to get, thinner bones more quickly. And especially you hadn't been able to exercise, which is one of the things that helps restore that. So now you are just in the process of going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And how?
It snapped. And so I was in a collapse. In a very large bundle because I'm not small, and I couldn't move, but I started to roar. There's something inside me that felt a level of pain I've never felt before, and all I could do was roar. I thought, well, at least you weren't screaming at the top of your lungs. What I was doing was I was roaring from some sort of primal space.
Wow.
And my therapist, when I told her this story, she said, well, that's the lion in you that was, fighting off the potential danger. Right.
Yeah.
I was very vulnerable, obviously. And I had my phone with me, which is, everybody keeps saying, thank God you had your phone with you, because my dog came in, but she couldn't help,
right.
I couldn't,
yeah.
There's nobody in the house. And I was insane with pain. There was, a rational side of me was saying, breathe, breathe, breathe. But I couldn't hold on to that for more than two breaths. And I would just then roar again, and this flood of pain.
Oh.
And I managed to call my husband. He didn't answer. And he said, he wrote me a text message, busy in a meeting.
Of course. I mean, I've done that 100 times when my wife calls, right? And vice versa. I'll call her and she'll say the same thing. So then what happened? How'd they get you?
Well, I texted my kids next, and my younger son was like, he didn't know what to do. And I felt so bad later that I did this to them. But my husband was on that text message too. And he eventually, you know, called and said, have you called 911? And at the same moment, I was about to call 911. So it dawned on me, I have a resource. There is a way to do this. And so I did. And eventually they talked me through the waiting period of the EMTs getting here. A neighbor came over. Mark had called a neighbor and figured out how to let them in because it, you know, I didn't know if their doors were all locked or not.
You can't move at this point, right?
No, I cannot move. I can't even lift my leg. Because I collapsed with the leg under me, the broken leg under me, which makes sense, you know, in physics, that you're sitting and then break, boom, on top. And I'm in the smallest bathroom in this sort of configuration where I'm sort of wedged in. Under the toilet, and there's a tub, and then you know, my head had hit the towel rack that was behind me, and let me get a second, getting overexcited here, and the EMTs came, and they eventually tried to find a vein to give me something I forget. Fentanyl.
Okay.
Just because they couldn't touch me. I was just like, this pain is too bad. You can't move me. But they tried. And eventually they found a vein, which was really hard. They struggled to do that. When the fentanyl kind of kicked in, they could move me a little bit. But man, it still hurt. Eventually they got me out. It was not easy. And they got the stretcher out of the house because it was in a weird angle of the house. And you know, I went to the hospital. It's a little blurry after that. My husband flew home.
He was way out of town.
He was in Nashville, yeah.
Okay.
We got to the hospital, and some people took over, you know, and I had surgery. I didn't even know that I was going to have surgery. I'm sure they told me, I'm sure they did everything proper. But I ended up with a titanium rod in my leg and two huge bolts.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest bolt is in my hip, and then the other one above the knee. I spent 5 days in the hospital just trying to, I don't know, figure things out.
Yeah,
and get through the pain. They made me get up right away.
So how long ago was that?
The break was December 14th. And the next week I was having a house full of relatives come in with Christmas holidays.
Did they still come?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh my God.
I wanted them there because they would help.
Oh, well, okay.
You know,
sure.
And my husband would need help, you know, and it was actually quite good.
They
were great, and I was on pretty good painkillers for the first few days,
but it's not like you are up and entertaining and making hors d'oeuvres and appetizers and serving dessert and plum pudding.
No, I didn't do any cooking at all,
right?
My family, this is Mark's side of the family, it's just so generous and so talented and smart, and we had a great Christmas. We really did. Despite the pain. I mean, I don't know.
So now you're a couple of months post break, and walking is obviously still a challenge for you, but that is your next goal, is to be able to walk. And you're still fighting some form of sarcoidosis at the same time, and you've had a lot of weight gain from the prednisone. So you're trying to work on a bunch of different things at the same time.
Indeed, John, you summed it up quite well. I finally made a list because I was really too overwhelmed after I came home from the hospital. I was hospitalized in the summer as well, by the way, after I had the cyclophosphamide, I got hyponatremia. I've never had that before.
Okay.
Low salt. You think it was a benign thing, but it's not. I was hospitalized for 3 days on that, and I gained a whole bunch of new doctors. I made this list. Now, after this episode, the bone break, I have a whole bunch of new doctors. So they're all there now. They're all like in this big mix of what Laura is supposed to do to get better. And I got an endocrinologist because the blood sugar and the bones, the osteoporosis. And so now I'm on osteoporosis medicine. I will be soon. Another infusion.
Right.
And my neurologists are not happy that we had MRIs done in January again. And they're the same, pretty much the same as a year ago.
Yep.
And so the inflammation in the brain and spinal cord are bothering my neurologist, both of them. And they want me to do something extra, but my rheumatologist has yet to respond.
And do they talk to each other? Can you get your doctors to confer?
Supposedly.
Are they all in the same hospital?
The Mayo Clinic ones are, yeah.
Okay.
I have local people to support the needs that I have on a more immediate basis.
Yeah.
So the people at the Mayo have a system of communicating with each other, and they all do read those notes. I picked up some new doctors or nurse practitioners who are great, by the way. I just love these nurse practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And they all see the notes. They see the history, and they have everything available that I have available on that system. But the problem I'm having is that one in particular, my rheumatologist, is very tardy in responding. And everybody mm-hmm. knows. I mean, I've called his office twice, three times, and the people say, yeah, he's kind of slow. He's kind of busy. He's out of town, you know, it's like all these things. So I'm waiting on that. That's a bit frustrating. But as you say, there are so many things I can work on. The weight loss, I'm doing more physical therapy, and if there's occupational therapy because my hands are getting a little bad. Or worse, I should say.
Do you still have the tingling in your fingers from the?
I have a lot of numbness. The whole left side is numb, honestly.
Okay.
There's a certain level of numbness. There's greater and lesser degrees of numbness in my feet. That yep. seems to come and go, but yep. There's always some level of numbness there. And in my left hand, both hands are kind of wobbly and shaky. They've been that way since the beginning. So I don't have fine motor control, which is, at first, that was really, really the big issue for me. But then walking became hard, so that became the big issue.
So are you taking gabapentin for the numbness by any chance?
I take Lyrica. I was on gabapentin for a long time. And then they said, I've forgotten now why, but they switched me to Lyrica. And that's what I'm on now.
Does it work?
Oh, yeah. It helps a lot. I mean, I can tell when I haven't taken it. And that's, you know, this is the best it gets, right? I was on a higher dosage of it, and the side effects were too much. It made me too sort of, it was just too much in my system. You know how you feel that sometimes? You feel like, I don't know how to describe it. It's not like walking through water, but it's kind of, you know, like you're kind of like, not woozy, but just slower than usual. Your reaction times are slower. And I wanted off of that. So I'm only on two pills a day.
Right. Wow. I tell you. So now you're walking with a cane and or a walker, but your goal is to go on a trip this summer where you'll need to be able to do about 3 miles.
Well, ideally I'll be able to take this walk. So here's the story, John. I've been working on this author from 17th century named Afra Ben. And she's a phenomenal woman. There's a vast international group of scholars who work on her. And there's a meeting at her home, birthplace, this summer in Canterbury, England. I want to go there because in addition to being a meeting, a conference where people share their research, on Afroben, there's also a lot of side things that are once in a lifetime for me, you know, sort of deals where we'll go, they erected a statue at her hometown, her birthplace, and I want to see that. And then there's a walk that goes through some of the places where she lived and things that she would have done. And I just want to see it. And that's about 3 miles. And I'm sure it's going to be stop and go. you know, it's just, it's a matter of stamina right now. I think I could do it. But I don't know that I have the stamina for it. I might ask my husband to wheel me around, but,
There's always a wheelchair. If you had to, you could still see it, still experience it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my goal. That's what I'm holding out. Trying to get there. And then I'll have to, you know, present some research that I have to, you know, work on. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And who was this author that you've been studying?
Her name is Aphra, A-P-H-R-A, Behn, B-E-H-N.
She was English?
Yeah, I know. It's a married name, probably. Her birth name was, I forgot.
Even the first name Aphra doesn't sound very
British. It's funny. There are certain towns where there's a lot of Aphras. And it can be spelled all different ways. It can be A-F-F-R-A, A-F-A-R-A. And she went by the pseudonym, not really pseudonym, but a pen name of Astraea, which is, I think the goddess of wisdom or something like that. Okay.
So she would have lived when? What century?
Oh, 17th century. We think she was born in 1640 and she died in 1689.
Okay. Wow. And is this somebody that those of us who are not English professors should know about?
I think so, of course, because everybody wants their person acknowledged. She is sort of known for being the first woman who made her living by her writing. It's not exactly true because there are some cookbook writers beforehand, but she's the first British woman to earn a living by writing literature. And she wrote primarily for the stage, which if anybody's interested in theater, you want to know her because her plays are still very performable. And they're very funny. She was a very funny woman. You can still see her work in all over. I had a student, a PhD student, who specialized on The Rover, which is her best known theatrical piece, that did the history of contemporary versions of The Rover. And I was shocked to see all the stages in America that were performing that. In the late 20th, early 21st century.
You study her and you are in her head, so to speak, because you're trying to think, what was she thinking? What was her motivation for doing this? And now you want to go and you want to walk the walk that she did and see where her inspiration came from, well as the commemorative stuff like the statue.
Yeah.
But you've got to get over your broken leg. And you've got to get your balance back, and you've got to go out and walk, and you've got to do it. But you are generally feeling better. You feel like 2024 is a year of rebirth for you.
I hope so, John. I every time I get to that edge when I believe in that, something happens. And you know the story of sarcoidosis. It's so unpredictable. I've been disappointed so many times over the last 2-3 years, that I just, I try to reserve a certain amount of, enthusiasm. I want to be positive. I am positive. It's not about wanting. I am positive. And I take joy in what I have right now. I don't want to, place too much emphasis on the future and getting better this year, because I have this fear that's, you know, it's just leading me to more disappointment.
Sure, sure. You just take it one day at a time.
One day. You know, I got down on the floor this week and was able to do yoga, which I hadn't been able to do, both because of the weight and because of the broken leg, for a month. And God, it felt so good just to be in that yoga space. I don't know if you've ever done yoga, but it's very mind and body. And so I find it very conducive to just feeling better, being at peace with what's going on in this very flawed body of mine.
Yeah. Well, I can see, I've seen your professional picture, your headshot for LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And I can see, just looking at you now here in our Zoom call, you are carrying some extra weight. And, oh, yeah. And
I'm
recognize
down.
That.
I'm down 15 pounds now.
Yeah. I gained over 30 pounds when I was on prednisone, and I, you know, I was doing similar doses, and I just, it's so hard. Have you changed your diet at all? Have you gone to an amazingly lean, clean eating regimen?
Yeah. More or less. The start of that was after I was diagnosed with MS. I started doing research on diet, because I always go to diet first. I'm a big, believer in food is medicine, and we need to, we can control very few things in life, but we can control what we put in our mouth.
Yep.
And so I started doing this MS diet. I forget, it was some sort of very enthusiastic, borderline crazy MS doctor who believed she could cure MS through diet. And I gave it a whirl, I lost a ton of weight. I wasn't that overweight to begin with. It was just the weight I'd gained as a chair. Then I got put on prednisone, and all of a sudden, the cheeks puffed out.
Moon
I
face.
I gained 60 pounds.
60?
60 pounds in a year. I wasn't used to being that way. I wasn't used to being in a body that way. And I learned a lot about it, but I did try to, control my eating. But there were times, I'll be honest, when I was like, this sucks so bad. I'm sorry for the language, but this is so bad. I'm just going to make a pie and eat it. I want to eat a pie. And I've been on, I'm a celiac person. I have a ton of autoimmune disease, but the celiac diet is, gluten-free. And so I've been gluten-free for a long time. So getting rid of the allergens as part of that crazy MS diet was getting rid of eggs, dairy, gluten, for me, soy, because I'm allergic to it. I'm forgetting one, dairy, eggs, wheat. Anyway, there's a lot of things, a lot of allergens. So I cleaned out that. In my moments of self-pity, I would eat a lot of potato chips.
I love potato chips, right?
It is hard to resist potato chips.
It is. It's so hard.
And but now I'm on the sugar monitor, and man, I can see the effect that has on the blood sugar.
It's right.
Any potato. Anyway, so yeah, I talked to a nutritionist who, I don't know, I get confusing information. I was trying to do fasting because I, intermittent fasting was a good thing. It was recommended, supported by my doctors. And then my bone broke, and I had to work on the osteoporosis. And the endocrinologist recommended a nutritionist who wanted to do the calorie deficit model. So calorie deficit model is very different from fasting. And so I get, I don't know, I'm trying very hard to keep track of my carbs and my proteins and my fat. And I only eat there are a few processed foods. I eat frozen foods, but for the most part, I eat everything from home, home cooked, home prepared, and low carb. I just don't eat a lot of carbs.
Yeah, you're doing everything right. You really are, and you're still kind of stuck, and it's just not fair.
Thank you, John. I appreciate hearing that, because that's the way I felt for a while.
It's just not fair, right? I mean, you just want to walk, and you're willing to make the sacrifices, and you're willing to commit to doing the right things, and still your body is not cooperating.
I want to know, John. I want to know from my body. I want it to tell me, what do you want?
And I'll do it. Uncle, I say uncle, you win. I'll do it. Right.
But I don't want to have the sarcoid. I just don't want to have it. The live inflammation. It's so dangerous. When I listen to these specialists on the FSR work, question and answer and workshops. Right. And yeah. I do all that. And they always say, you know, neurosarcoidosis, very, very rare. In a multi-system, also very rare. And when you have resistant neurosarcoidosis, and you're just, you know, that's the only time you have to worry. These guys, that's my takeaway. So I have to worry, because apparently this is a very dangerous category to be in.
Yeah. Well, we have been talking for nigh on to an hour now. So I just want to wish you the best 2024 you can have. I hope you make it to England.
Yes.
And you get to see Afra's origins and see what was inspiring her, and then that inspires you for your writing and your research, and that the leg continues to heal, and that the sarcoidosis can be controlled.
That's my hope. We'll see what's next.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk.
I feel like a zombie, just feeding at stumbling.
Our thanks to Laura for sharing her story. Let's hope she is able to walk that trail in England. We wish her all the best and a speedy recovery on the in terms of the broken leg. And then, of course, to Royce for all his efforts to raise money with his Cycle for Sarc program. The official Sarc Fighter song is called Zombie by Mark Steyer and his band, the White Hot Lizards, in Alberta, Canada. Mark's a fellow Sarc Fighter, and you can hear the story behind the lyrics way back in episode 12. Normally, I release the podcast every other Monday. As I'm speaking today, my trusty dog, Dougal, and his shadow, my new puppy, Shandy, are off wrestling in the living room. I wish I could say that they were keeping me company here in the office today, but I think Shandy's feeling rambunctious, and Dougal is, he is helping her out by tussling with her in the living room. I hope they don't break the coffee table. The backstory to the founding of the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research is episode 11 with Andrea and Redding Wilson. Andrea is a fellow Sarc fighter, and she and her husband started this at their kitchen table. Don't forget to follow Sarc Fighter on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Peloton. I have a cycling blog, which I have not updated lately, but I keep threatening to. But it's called Carlin the Cyclist, and there is a section in there called Cycling with Sarcoidosis. In fact, that's how I first met Royce. He reached out after reading one of my posts, and we've stayed in touch ever since. Also, if you're new here and you're just trying to figure out what Sarc is, try listening to episode 2 with Dr. Simon Hart. My story is episode 1. And please send me an email if you'd like to appear on the show, or if you just have a question or anything you want to talk about regarding sarcoidosis. I'm always here for you. CarlinAgency@gmail.com, and there's a link in the show notes. Until next time, keep fighting.
Learn to suffer, you feel your pain someday. Learn endurance, your strength will fade away. Dead man walking, trying to keep up the pace. Dead man walking.